Welcome to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts and storytelling. I'm your host, Ashley Ann Krigbaum. My love affair with radio began with music. I grew up in a tiny rural community on the fringes of the San Francisco Bay, and radio was the most readily available broadcast media I had within reach. It wasn't NPR that lit my fire back then, but music stations, specifically, quote-unquote, oldies stations.
The legendary Big 610 AM and 99.7 FM.
KFRC, San Francisco.
I'd sit on my bedroom floor with my tape deck on hand, ready to record my favorite songs. And now, as a radio producer, I think that music has the ability to make the best radio stories. The first piece I'd like to share with you today is one such story, one that could only be told in an audio medium. Independent radio producer and musician Joshua Sorodiak is trying to solve a mystery around the identity and history of an entire genre of music.
This is the sound of the modern second line. Or at least these are the sounds coming from one of the bands currently at the top of the second line scene. They're called the Hot 8 Brass Band, and like the originators of this music, they came directly from the streets of New Orleans. So what is second line? I'm a tuba player who has spent the last 15 years listening to the sounds. I even played in a working second line band for a year. And as a black man who was raised by a white mother with no father, the music moves me in a way that is hard to put into words. But I'm a Midwesterner who spent 10 of the last 12 years in San Francisco. What do I really know? To find out what a second line really is, I decided to talk with some experts. The first person I spoke with was Al Lazard.
That's my name, Al Lazard.
And to him, second lining is a family affair. I asked him about his father, Dutt.
Dutt.
I'm sorry, Dutt.
My dad is a big part of New Orleans second line culture. He is Grand Marshal of Treme Brass Band. We started the 30 Dozen Brass Band with Kirk and all those guys. You know, he's been part of the second line movement. My dad had me second lining at 2 years old. At 5 years old, I was in the streets second line with him. Now it's become mainstream, but New Orleans, when it was just neighborhood thing, because second line is what you call second line. It's a street, and so he was all part of that. He was a major in it. He was big time. He was in social clubs, social pleasure clubs.
I asked Al to tell me more about social aid and pleasure clubs. For folks that aren't from New Orleans, can you talk a little bit about what purpose those organizations served in the community?
This is just my own take of it. In New Orleans, the big crews are the ones that have the big parades, you know, Bacchus, the big parades, the whole Mardi Gras thing they have in New Orleans. That would be called the first line, Zulu balls, all the, and a lot of times they didn't let blacks in them. So blacks wasn't allowed to be a part of these big clubs they have. The parades that they have, the mainstream parades that they have, and the people going out for Mardi Gras, those are all done, you know. They're mostly a white club. They are all white clubs. Blacks wasn't allowed in clubs. So what the black community decided to do was they started to start their own clubs, social and pleasure clubs. And every Sunday, they have a second line. They have their own parade where they don't have to be a part of that mainstream parade. So that's why it's behind the scenes. Unless you live in somewhere where it's at, you won't see a second line unless you know somebody that told you about the second line. There's a whole other party going on that unless you know someone, you won't even know it where it's at. And that's the second line.
Clubs, crews, gangs. I went to speak with Al's friend Kirk, who plays sousaphone for the Dirty Dozen Brass Band, to get his take on second line.
How you doing? My name is Kirk Joseph, sousaphone player from New Orleans, Louisiana, here in Chicago, doing a little radio shoot down with my boy here, talking about some New Orleans stuff, you know what I'm saying, from sousaphone player to sousaphone player and then to y'all. So here we go.
What second line is it?
It's tribal.
Okay.
It's tribal, you know. Yeah. I mean, you know where we come from, our people anyway. You know, other people do it too, but it originates with our people of color. You know, meaning African Americans. You know what I'm saying? And it's. But then you brought you know the gospel into it. You know, a little bit more jazzier. You know, not just strict marches. You know what I'm saying? So when you brought the gospel into it, you definitely moved yourself. You know what I'm saying? With no doubt about it, but to move yourself. So.
Was just handed to the, you know, to the second line procession of thousands of people from the church to the streets. And it just was fascinating to me because it seemed like it was a giant family, like a giant family reunion.
That's the voice of Richard Brent Turner, professor of religious studies and African American studies at the University of Iowa. From 1996 through 1999, he lived in New Orleans while teaching at Xavier University. And he currently has a book out from Indiana University Press titled Jazz Religion, The Second Line, and Black New Orleans. We met at a coffee shop in Iowa City where Dr. Turner explained to me his experience at the funeral of Big Chief Donald Harrison, one of New Orleans' Mardi Gras Indians.
And the dancing was just fascinating. The African dancing, the energy of the people who were participating in the dancing. There just were so many different things going on. There were the Mardi Gras Indians who were wearing their suits that, you know, they spent months making from feathers and beadwork, fascinating beadwork, scenes of bravery of Native Americans and African chiefs depicted in the beadwork, which is usually on the chest of the suit. And they had African drumming going on in different circles. There were obviously voodooists there. People were practicing African religions, wearing distinctive white clothing. And there were chants, almost kind of hypnotic chants that drew you into different drumming circles where people were chanting. The leaders of these secret societies were chanting things in Creole. You might not know what they were saying, but you said it and you followed it.
Dr. Turner and I went back to his office, where we dug deeper into the racial dynamics historically at play in New Orleans.
Because that's another part of the story as to how second line tradition is able to, bring together all of these different traditions from Africa, from the Caribbean, from Christianity, because New Orleans in the early 1800s was a city where there was more racial mixing going on than any other place in the United States. And in fact, when Americans took over New Orleans with the Louisiana Purchase, they were appalled because they were seeing people of brown skin color with baby blue eyes. They were seeing, you know, slaves who were of African descent, but, you know, physically, some of them clearly looked like white people. They were seeing black people and white people interacting with one another in social settings during Mardi Gras. Of course, underneath that were some very dominating and brutal power relationships. New Orleans was governed by a different set of racial doctrines. In most of the United States where people of African descent were enslaved, there was a one-drop rule. Now, New Orleans was governed by the Code Noir. The Code Noir was a lot more complex.
And this brings us to one of the most significant aspects of the story behind Second Line, Congo Square. Because of those racial norms which went back to colonial times and which were unique in what would come to be the United States, slaves in New Orleans were more able to hold on to the culture that they brought with them from Africa. Even during slavery, when blacks were forced to work from sunrise to sunset 6 days a week, on the 7th, Sunday, we were allowed to come together and remember Africa. In New Orleans, Congo Square is where this coming together occurred. And unlike most of the rest of the places on the continent where blacks were enslaved, in Congo Square, the drum was not outlawed. Now, this is not the end of this story. When I moved back to Chicago in 2011, I began trying to get a group together, wanting to recreate the sense of belonging to a tribe that I got from playing with a second line band in San Francisco. We're calling ourselves the Swelligant Brass Band, and we're just starting to play out. Look for us parading down a street in your neighborhood.
For Vocalo, this is Joshua Serodiak.
That piece was produced as part of the Vocalo Storytellers Workshop. Vocalo is a public media organization and radio station here in the U.S. that connects culturally diverse audiences through music, stories, and training. They have a bunch of fantastic podcasts available, most of which focus on music, and you can find them all at their website, vocalo.org. You're listening to The Spot, the show that features the best stories from podcasts and independent radio producers. I'm Ashley Ann Krigbaum. Since we're on the topic of radio producers exploring the relationships we have between identity and music, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention local public radio legends, the Kitchen Sisters. On their podcast, Fugitive Waves, you'll regularly hear stories about music makers from not just the Bay Area, but across the world. On the show, they've walked a march route with San Francisco's Green Street Mortuary Band.
For years, we were watching this brass band with this buxom blonde, who's the leader, round the corner after they played the funeral, jump into the open limos and speed off back to the Italian section of North Beach. And we thought, find out about that funeral band. What's the story? Those are some definite fugitive waves going on there.
Shared stories from musicians about their memories of playing alongside Edith Piaf.
Back in Paris when I was small, all Somaloid had a fair, wonderful.
And even discovered a hidden musical history of an island smack dab in the middle of the Thames River in London.
Did we order the eels and take them back to the studio to share with the singers? No, not this first time.
There's a musical beauty to all of the stories the Kitchen Sisters produce, and I'd like to share one that's especially important to San Francisco.
You're listening to Fugitive Waves, lost recordings and charts of sound, along with news stories of remarkable people from around the world. Stories from the flip side of history. We're the Kitchen Sisters, Davia Nelson and Nikki Silva.
We first heard about Teresa Sparks at the very first pop-up magazine in San Francisco. Pop-up. It's a magazine performed live on stage. It's not recorded in any way. Radio producers, writers, filmmakers, photographers. It starts with the short matter. You know how with a magazine, you have a paragraph or a photograph, and then the articles get longer and longer as the magazine goes. Well, that's what pop-up is. The first presenter might be 30 seconds long, or then a minute long, or then 2 minutes for the next. It's maybe 20 presentations in the course of the night. And the very first pop-up, we got invited to participate, and they said, present an outtake or a first draft or an excerpt of something you've never done before, something you might only know the middle of. Maybe you've just got one juicy morsel, but you can't figure out the whole story. And it was 20 different presenters all working off of outtakes and drafts and works in progress, and it was one of the most exhilarating nights we'd ever been part of. Nobody knew what they were getting into. Nathaniel Johnson, writer and radio producer, got up on stage and told some of the story of Teresa Sparks. And we were just starting a series on NPR called The Hidden World of Girls, Girls and the Women They Become. It's about coming of age and rituals and rites of passage and women crossing the line, blazing a trail, changing the tide, and everything that Nathaniel mentioned about Teresa just mesmerized us. And we came to Nathaniel afterwards and told him about the series and asked if we could collaborate on a story for the series with him about Teresa. At the time, Teresa was running for supervisor in San Francisco, but that wasn't what the story turned out to be. Here's what happened.
My name is Teresa Sparks. I live in San Francisco. I grew up in the Midwest, outside of Kansas City. It was kind of the beaver cleaver childhood, you know, and I was kind of the beaver. I was always a good student. Your typical, normal Midwestern kid. My first wife was the love of my life. 6 days apart in age, and we were born in the same hospital, and we actually lived next door to one another. We got married and had 3 kids.
My name is Adam Sparks. I am the son of Teresa Sparks. I live in Overland Park, Kansas. It's always been a pretty traditional family, except for the obvious stuff, obviously. My dad was a guy's guy, you know, he was a dad's dad. He wore snakeskin boots, had a Harley, had a muscle truck that had like 500 horsepower. We would do things like, you know, rewire the house to the main box. We always went and got a tool the week, Saturday morning, you know, get up and go get the tool of the week.
People ask me, when did I decide, or when did I discover, or when did I know? You always know there's something just kind of a half a click off, but you're not sure what it is. I'd been dressing in female clothes secretly since I was a young boy. Did I think I was a girl? No, not really. I would go out and I'd go to a Kmart or something and buy women's clothes and then go to a bathroom at a service station and I'd change my clothes. It always had to be dark. And just drive around and have no contact with anyone. When I stopped at the stoplight, I would stop back far enough so they couldn't look in my car and then go back to the service station and throw the clothes away. You know, I wasn't trying to fool anybody. In fact, I was petrified that somebody would see me.
There weren't really any signs. My dad engineered and built refineries all over the world, waste management, recycling. When I was in high school, my dad was the president and CEO of a company that recycled the waste off the bottom of the San Diego Bay.
I've coached soccer. I coached baseball. I was in the Navy. I had a beard and I smoked cigars, everything I could to try to push back this thing, keep it at bay. I think a lot of people in this situation, they believe, if I can just get married and have a great relationship, it'll go away. I can beat this thing. I had to bring this out into the open. And I remember both my wives saying, do you want to be a woman? And I was telling the same answer, I have no idea. You know, and in both cases, that resulted in destroying the marriages.
He kept it pretty well hidden right up until my brother was graduating boot camp. My dad came to that, and his hair was a little bit long and wavy, and he kind of looked like Michael Douglas at a Romancing the Stone or something. So we drive out to the cemetery to go see his brother and dad's grave. And that's where my dad told us. He was basically a woman in a man's body. You know, I started crying. My sister started crying. My brother just said, get in the car and spit on the ground. And we just kind of left my dad sitting there in the cemetery.
I went to Thailand and had surgery. Gender reassignment surgery. Once you're completed, you can legally change your gender on legal documents. Then I came back and I had no relationship with anybody from my former life whatsoever. All my people I'd worked with had stopped talking to me. You know, my kids, the relationship was very strained.
I mean, I didn't speak to my dad after that day for a decade. Yeah, I mean, it was like straight from the muscle truck and the Harley and the BMW to I'm selling everything and I'm going to go have surgery on my genitals. I kind of dealt with it like my father had just passed away. I don't know how many years my dad didn't have a job. I would imagine it would be pretty tough for a trans person at 52 years old to get a job.
I answered a job at one of the best known female sex toy companies in the country, Good Vibrations. I went to work in their shipping department. I went from packer shipper to CEO of the company and ran the company for several years.
My name is Margaret Cho, and I am a stand-up comedian. I met Teresa through working on the board for Good Vibrations. She is this incredible business mind. When I think of her, I think about almost a literary character like Orlando, somebody who lives for a period of time as a man and then lives as a woman.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is the regular meeting of the San Francisco Police Commission.
I'd gotten involved in some political activities based on violence against transgender people. And at that point, I got totally thrust into San Francisco politics.
I am Senator Mark Leno, representing the 3rd California State Senate District of San Francisco, Marin, and Sonoma counties. I first met Teresa Sparks when I was serving on the San Francisco County Board of Supervisors. She was appointed by Willie Brown to serve on the Human Rights Commission and was subsequently appointed to become a police commissioner.
Last night, the city's police commission voted to make Sparks its leader, making her possibly the first transgender person to head.
My name is Gary Delanis, president of the San Francisco Police Officers Association. We had some difficult times at the beginning. We butted heads a lot in the first year. She wouldn't take any of my crap, and I didn't take any of hers.
When I was considering who my office would choose as our 13th Assembly District's Woman of the Year, it seemed fitting that I would choose Teresa. And so we brought Teresa to Sacramento. A few nights later, Jay Leno decided to make note of this in his monologue on his late show. The joke line was something like, "Leave it to California to choose a man as Woman of the Year." Teresa rose above it. She's seen it all.
Welcome back, everyone, to the 38th Annual Pride Parade, United by Pride, Bound for Equality.
My name's Lee Militello. I'm a lieutenant with the San Francisco Police Department. I can remember the first time Teresa rode in that parade as a police commissioner with the LGBT cops. We have now about 250 lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender police officers in our police department.
Here comes another Grand Marshal.
Yay! This is Teresa Sparks, a Lifetime Achievement Grand Marshal, the first elected openly transgender president of the San Francisco Police Commission. That was in 2007.
And she's riding with her two daughters and Margaret Cho.
Normally when people look at me, their first response isn't transgender until I talk. You know, I've taken voice lessons. I was the voice therapist. I had surgery on my vocal cords, which could have left me without a voice. Finally, at some point, you just kind of give up. You know, it is what it is.
He was over at my sister's for Thanksgiving, so I just went over there, and that was the first time. My dad still talked the same. Still wearing jeans, they just were tight. You know, still had shoes on, they just happened to have 3-inch heels. Same hands, just fingernail polish. Hair was red. It was almost like my dad was walking around, you know, in the wrong suit for 50-something years. And then finally was wearing the right suit.
The Secret and Not-So-Secret Life of Teresa Sparks was produced by the Kitchen Sisters with Nathaniel Johnson and Nathan Dalton, mixed by Jeremiah Moore. Here's a little more from Margaret Cho, who, when we interviewed her for this story, was on the set as a guest on Dancing with the Stars.
My name is Margaret Cho, and I am a stand-up comedian. I guess I'm an actor, too, and a musician from San Francisco. I loved being in the San Francisco Gay Pride Parade with Teresa. I think San Francisco Gay Pride is really different from any other parade. There's so much history there. There's so much depth to the celebration. It just makes me want to cry. And to stand up there with Teresa. With all that Teresa has done for the gay community, it's wonderful to see her celebrated.
If someone didn't know Teresa, what would you tell them about her?
She is a mom, she is a politician, an activist, this incredible business mind. She's a businesswoman, but at the same time, she also has a lifetime where she was a businessman. It is an amazing story. She went through this transition and then came back to head the police commission. It takes a special person to change your identity, change your body, change your name, and do all this to really become yourself.
I'm kind of an engineer, you know, I'm trained as an engineer, and so I have this, you know, very organized way of approaching. So what I did was went back to my year of birth, found out what were the most popular names girls were named in 1949. And then I took the top 20, and then I looked at my first name initial, which was T, and Teresa's the one I landed on. My middle name is kind of odd in that I've had three serious relationships with women in my life, and all three of them had the same middle name. The two people I married, both middle name were Louise, and the one other serious relationship I had, her name was Louise. It had to be. That's the only middle name I could take.
Margaret, lastly, will you describe Teresa? Describe what she looks like. It's radio, so I want people to just have a kind of an image of her.
Teresa Sparks is a very beautiful, elegant woman. She's a very maternal quality, incredibly classy. I love her in a 40s neckline, a Joan Crawford kind of silhouette. She is a fiery redhead that you don't want to get her mad, you know. She is always very comfortable in a leader position and in a place of power. That's really what we need in San Francisco, and we need it everywhere. But somebody like that who takes charge very quietly, her quiet strength is really profound. She's got such a brilliant mind and such capacity for love and change.
Fugitive Waves is produced by the Kitchen Sisters, Nikki Silva and Davia Nelson, with Nathan Dalton and Brandy Howell. You can find their podcast on iTunes or at radiotopia.fm.
Hey over there. Hey, Mr. DJ. Next time you play a record, make sure the needle's in the groove. The edge doesn't sound so nice.
That's it for today's episode of The Spot. You can find this episode and more at kalw.org. We have a playlist on soundcloud.com too. Search for it under KALW. And tell me what you want to hear on The Spot. If you have a suggestion for a podcast we should feature, please drop me a line at thespot@kalw.org. I've received some excellent tips lately, thank you so much, and I was so happy to even air one this week. Tune in next Thursday, same time, for another episode of The Spot, only on KALW San Francisco.